This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
You are watching the Deadfoot Diver Podcast with Kurt the Deadfoot Diver.
Welcome to the Deadfoot Diver Podcast, where we talk about everything diving, tech diving, and especially the benefits of diving with disabilities. Today, I'm very pleased to have on with me a world-renowned marine archaeologist, James Delgado. How's it going?
It's going good. How are you?
Awesome. So glad that you could join me. Thanks for coming on today. I have always wanted to meet you. I have been a big fan of yours, actually, since you worked with Mike on the Sea Hunters.
Wow, that's been a while.
So tell me how you first got into diving and then what brought you into doing marine archaeology.
Well, actually, I mean, I've always had a fascination with the water and boats and ships. Both grandfathers had boats. And so I drove a boat long before I ever drove a car. But the thought of what was not only on the water but under it was fascinating. Now, my love of archaeology initially was with prehistoric sites, but it was in 1978, and I was living in San Francisco as a Park Service, a National Park Service historian, and they found a ship buried 12 blocks from the sea in downtown San Francisco. And that ship, Niantic, was so fascinating because as they excavated down, and we're now about 20-odd feet below the streets and sidewalks, in this huge pit, they had to pump because the tide still came in on what had been the beach. But with that, because the ship had been inundated in the water table, things were very well preserved. You could still smell the fire that had burned it in May of 1851. You could smell the salt in the water as it came out in its sort of brackish form. And things were so nicely preserved that the copper sheathing, the moment it was first exposed, shone as bright as a penny that had just been minted and then oxidized. But leather jackets, bottles of perfume, sacks of peanuts, all sorts of things that had been stored in this thing, it was like, wow, this was kind of a grody, charred, muddy Tut's tomb. And with that, I said, I got to go switch my career from land archaeology to maritime archaeology. So I could still dig, like in downtown San Francisco. And I did work on other ships that were caught up in the gold rush and then separately buried as a result of post-rush landfill. But it also led to me wanting to learn to dive. The Park Service didn't have its own dive school, so they shipped me off to the Presidio of San Francisco, where Master Sergeant Dutch Bowen trained me and another archaeologist as part of an Army dive school in how to go embrace the underwater realm, in this case, on the Northern California coast and in San Francisco Bay. In short, you can't see anything. You largely can only hear a few things there and off in the distance. What was the politically incorrect term that was used at the time? The Helen Keller School of Diving.
Been there, done that.
Yeah. I have to say, every time I've ever been in it, in difficult situations, it's been that training. Particularly, you know, Master Sergeant Bowen reminding us early on, there's old divers, there's bold divers, there's no old bold divers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you actually did a full military diving course.
No, but Dutch did that on the side. This was for those of us who weren't, we were wearing uniforms, just not Army uniforms.
Oh, so you didn't have to do all the crazy stuff that they,
we had to do versions of the crazy stuff. You know, when you've got guys in the pool jumping on you and attacking you and tearing your gear off, that kind of stuff. Yeah. The Park Service then put us through their own tests, and that was fun because we had saltwater checkouts, and then we had a freshwater checkout, and the freshwater was in Lake Mead, where they would do stuff like take you into the intake tubes for the Hoover Dam, take your lights away, open your air up, and then in the dark you have to, you know, okay, reconnect things, and then get out without a light.
In the Hoover Dam.
In the Hoover Dam. Or, you know, they put guys in vehicles and then in gear, and then they'd roll you off the end of the dock, or you'd do a Dauphin Don at, you know, 30 feet. But what was the other one? It was crawling through sewer pipe. You had like a long length of sewer pipe, and you'd have to shift off and then shove and crawl through this pipe, keeping, you know, your reg in your mouth and pushing it. So yeah, any time I've ever been in the stuff, yeah, in diving, it's always been Bowen's training. It's why I got to this stage and to this age, actually, with all the diving.
That's very cool. So, I mean, everybody remembers their first dive instructor that they had and the training that they instilled in on them, hopefully good in most cases.
Oh, yeah. No, I have nothing but the highest respect for Master Sergeant Bowen, if he's still out there. Thank you, Dutch. It's been a long time since I chatted with him.
Very cool. So then where did you progress from there in your career?
Well, with the Park Service, I ended up working with our Submerged Resources team. Did a lot of work, again, in California. That's where I learned how to use a hard hat, for example. But also diving up in the North Coast before it was too sharky, but sharky enough. Drake's Bay, the Channel Islands, in and out of San Francisco Bay, off the Golden Gate, you name it. So I did that work. That ultimately took me out into the Pacific with the guys. We worked at Pearl Harbor doing dives on Arizona and Utah and other sites in the harbor. And then we did projects in Bikini on the A-bomb ships. We were the first government team to go back in a long time. And we did a series of dives both on Saratoga, Nagato, Pilotfish, and a number of the other wrecks there back in 89 and 90, including penetration dives into the carrier, which was just amazing. My last Park Service dives also involved work out in the Gulf of Mexico, the Dry Tortugas, and then in Mexico, where we worked with our colleagues there to dive on the U.S. Navy's brig Summers, which had sunk during the Mexican War and was the subject of a very famous mutiny and subsequently had been lost under the commander Rafael Semmes, sitting out there blockading the port of Veracruz. So that was Park Service. I then went up to Vancouver, joined a number of folks and dived, and then started working with Mike and Warren Fletcher and the others in the team of the Sea Hunters, went back and dived later as president of the Institute of Nautical Archaeology, primarily, you know, sites in Europe. And then with NOAA, as director of Maritime Heritage, I went through NOAA dive exams and started diving again. And kept going until I just recently hung it up after my third spinal surgery.
Wow, so you're not diving at all now?
The last dive I made was in about, 10 feet of water in the Mobile River, diving on the slave ship Clotilda, and that was just about a year and a half ago. Now I sit like this as a robot goes down 15,000 feet and tell the guys with the ROV, yeah, go into that hangar bay. Let's go see what's in there.
Safer from that aspect of it, but don't you miss some of the deep diving stuff that you've gotten to do?
I do, but I mean, at this stage, it's been a few thousand dives. I've seen a lot. I've dived the seven seas. And I'm now the old diver. I was occasionally bold, and there were a couple scrapes, but no, it's good. This is a good place to be.
How old are you now?
About to turn 68.
Cool. All right. So, I mean, I know guys who are diving, like, still in there. Well, Mike, for example, look at all the crazy stuff he still does.
Oh, absolutely.
So,
but he's a great diver, and he's well trained.
Yeah, Mike is. I actually met Mike back in the 90s originally. My mother actually helped a lot with him on his Atlantic Preservation Project. So that was actually, I can say that is my most disappointing day of my life, was the day him, Warren, and Dennis Barrington and me went out to try and dive the Atlantic, and we got blown out.
Yeah, that happens. And my dives in the lake, I've seen that happen. And I guess I've dived in pretty much all of the lakes.
What's your
even on the Canadian and American sides.
What's your favorite dive out of all the ones that you have done since you've done thousands of dives?
The one after I got married and I took my wife on her first wreck dive.
Oh, cool. Which wreck was that?
It was the dual mix of the Constellation and Civil War Blockade Runner that inspired Benchley to write The Deep in Bermuda.
Wow, very cool.
And I knew then that we were right for each other, because not only did she do that and go through that dive experience, and it started shallow, Constellation's on the reef, and it's full of glass and all sorts of things, including ampules of morphine that inspired that aspect of Benchley's book. But she was drawn to that, and the marine life and the color and the iridescence of the glasses. It had changed in the seawater. And then we went deeper, and she said, I kept looking for the fish, and all you wanted to do is look at rusty stuff. And I said, perfect, perfect, because she had her interest in diving, I had mine, and we could appreciate each other's interests and roll with it as a couple. And so therein has been the key to success in this now nearly 40-year marriage.
Wow. And does she still dive too?
No. Ah. No.
She decided...
No, I mean, we... yeah, we Canada was too dark and cold for her.
I can't imagine why.
Well, I told her, once you get out on the west side of Vancouver Island, you know, you're in that Emerald Sea. That's pretty awesome.
But she said, yeah. It's definitely amazing diving out of there. I mean, I'm consider myself lucky for at least leaving you on Ontario. I'm only about an hour and a half south of Tobermory. So
right.
It's good that way. At least I can finish my shift in the morning, go up and do a charter in the afternoon.
Perfect. Well, she also knows, I mean, the dives that we did up in the Arctic, she was like, no, she doesn't like the cold. Smart woman.
Cannot blame her on that. I lived in the Arctic for 2 years, so I definitely get that. And I mean, I don't like the cold either. In fact, when I started diving last year, the first thing I went out and bought was a dry suit.
Yeah. Yeah, I had two great dry suits. I'm about to retire them both.
Ah, very cool. So, you did a lot of diving on the... Tell me about your work on the Arizona, because that's a wreck that I've always been fascinated with.
Well, Arizona, of course, isn't that deep. It's a snag hazard in a way, if you look at it like that. For me, and I think for the rest of the team, and I'm not speaking for the guys, it's one of the more profound dives to make, because not only is it there in the newsreel or in photographs, it's very clear when you see it from the memorial or when you dive it as to the exceptionally difficult conditions that those guys faced in fighting in a harbor. And the power of the explosion that tore the bow area apart and engulfed that ship in that fireball and literally blew chunks of the ship and crew over a mile. You look at that. The surveys later showed that the entire hull had been deformed by the shock wave. The level of heat in the fires that burned the forward turret, which has collapsed down, and when you swim past that, and you come up in those barrels, the trunnions are broken, so the barrels hang down. And you're there, and you're looking at that. Behind you is a garden of steel, just bent and twisted deck frames and plating that come up where the bow literally tore off and everything went up. And you're hanging there, and you realize that you're floating over where the bulk of her dead are. And particularly the guys in that turret. And you just, again, I mean, whether you look through an open port and you see a desk with a phone still on it and things of that sort, because the aft area is a little more intact. And that's where, when they recovered guys, they found them. To a cluster of fire hose on the deck where these guys had been fighting the fires that had started from the earlier bomb hits. And my father was a firefighter, and so I get this. The lines are still out in deployed position, and you realize as you look at them where they are on the deck that those guys were still there fighting when that last blast went off, and they literally died at their posts. And you get that sense of it as you swim over that fire hose. You know exactly what you're seeing.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, it's unfortunate that I'd like to hear your perspective from this, because I think that they should allow diving on wrecks like that, even if it's not touching it, just for people to be able to appreciate. What do you think about that?
I have no problem with most wrecks being accessible. Arizona is different. Arizona very early on became a symbol. For Americans, I think of the attack itself. It became a sacred place. And so to that end, even we had to go through hoops and we needed to approach our dives in a very careful way. I think when the decision was made to put the memorial there, that was a clear decision by the people of the United States, not just the government, to say, this is a sacred tomb. You can only approach in this way and reflect on it and see it through the water, and it does stick up. But that's it. Now, with that, of course, we worked pretty closely with the Navy to not only document the wreck, but to give people a sense of what it looked like underwater. And the later projects to scan it and to make it available 3D, all of that speaks to it. Now, yeah, I agree. You know, it'd be a great dive for some folks, and I'm one of the few that's been able to do so. But in this case, we very carefully listened to the families, and that included the survivors. And I participated in interring one of those guys back in the ship to be with his shipmates. And when you drop down into the well of that number 4 turret, you can see the various urns up against the sidewalls. That's like opening somebody's family tomb and opening the door and then looking at all the coffins in there or the cremains in their urns. Not everyone's comfortable with that. But other wrecks out in the ocean, as long as the approach is respectful and you're not taking pictures of yourself with the dead, then I think it's absolutely okay to dive.
Yeah, one of the things that I've seen repeatedly on videos of Truck Lagoon is when divers used to go down and take pictures of them lifting up a skull, or which is not cool.
No, it's not cool, but everybody has their bad characters or their bad actors who will do that kind of stuff. We've all had that jackass friend, but that doesn't speak for every diver.
No,
nor does it speak to every wreck diver.
So while we're on that subject, and since you're a marine archaeologist, I have another question for you, and that is, what is your opinion of salvage of shipwrecks or like treasure galleons, for instance, and stuff? Because I worked for Mel Fisher back in the 90s. So I personally do not have a problem with recovering that type of stuff, because as far as I'm concerned, the ocean's going to gobble it up as far as the stuff goes anyways. I guess also though with the marine laws, even here in Canada, as you know, they're pretty strict. You're supposed to not be able to, supposed to not take anything off a wreck. However, we know that happens. So,
yeah. Well, look, I'm an archaeologist. So with that, you do get a sense of human behavior. I also, you know, worked for the public in the Park Service and at NOAA. I get that people like to collect. Absolutely. We all collect in one way or the other, whether it's something that you find on a trail or for some people something that they find on a dive. But there are things that have meanings for folks. Right behind me on the shelf is a rock that the minister gave me as my mother lay dying. And it's probably one of the more sacred things I have. So yes, people do have this desire, and objects speak to themselves. I worked pretty closely with divers in a variety of cases. I think where archaeologists get upset is if you get to a site where you've got to take an approach that's very careful and scientific. And I'm not talking about piles of gold coins. I'm saying we've gone to sites and in the Mediterranean, and somebody's gone through and they've collected every bit of pottery. And it may have taken us a few years to get there, but it's like, I remember diving over in Albania, a wreck that had not been seen or dived because they'd made it illegal. And we were the first to dive. And I'm not talking about legal on that wreck. You just didn't dive in Albania under that regime.
Really?
And they were just starting to open it up. And this Roman wreck had been sitting there since about 300 AD. The crew's dinner dishes were still there lying at the stern. You could see exactly what end was which. There was their wine pitcher. There were their plates. There's the other stuff. And you go, okay. It was, of course, thousands of years had passed. But just the same, it was almost as if they'd left. And so what would have hurt our interpretation and understanding of that and being able to tell more of the story through our CSI approach as archaeologists would have just been taken away by folks who said, oh, that's a cool plate. And then in some cases, we're never able to say for sure, oh, yeah, it came exactly from here or it even came from that wreck. So that's where archaeologists get upset. I think what ultimately happened is that through the years, wreck divers who like to collect and archaeologists, everybody started to better understand each other. And let's also be honest, how many of us are left that actually even do that kind of deep or challenging diving? That the later generations have less interest in it. So I'm realistic. When they passed laws in the States, I was one of those who had to come up with rules for them. And the law allowed for divers to collect in certain states, and we left it to each state to make their own decision. Treasure hunting, archaeologists get upset because oftentimes they see that the push is, let's get all that gold and push the other stuff aside. But look, there's multiple reasons people care about wrecks. There's multiple reasons for why we approach them the way they do. And what I've tried to do is just give a sense of everybody's perspective. And that's why when I wrote this, the new one. So I talk about why people care about wrecks in different ways. And I'm not being judgmental as why people care about these in different ways. I point out why people like it, why some people don't like it. And with that, I mean, with shipwrecks, you have wrecks that somebody really likes to dive and see it as unchanged as they can because it's a cool dive. And the dive operators want to see that. Then you see the people that want to fish on it. And then you see those people saying, wait a minute, you want to excavate it and remove it? Or you want to treasure hunt it and salvage it? Okay. But then you've got the other folks who say, wait a minute, there, it's an artificial reef, man. And there's all these fish that are living there. The fishermen say, yeah. But the other folks are like, well, it's part of the natural environment. And so, yeah, other people say, wait a minute, my grandfather died on that. So how do you balance all that? You can't always do it perfectly. But the one thing I learned through all my years as a government policy person really was that you have to listen to everybody. And everybody has a different take or a different sense of value. And to the best you can, you try to accommodate that. And to that end, I mean, I think that's one of the great values we celebrate as being Canadian, right?
Yeah. True. So, do you still live in Canada? Whereabouts are you now?
I'm in Washington, D.C. these days. I married a local girl.
Ah, cool. Washington, that's on my list. I want to go to the Smithsonian.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, tell me, in all of the exploration that you've done, what has been the most challenging expedition that you've been on, and why?
Wow. Well, whether it's getting everything put into a small plane and flying all the way out thousands of miles to go to Bikini, or with my late friend John Pollock, getting everything into a small twin otter and flying and landing in a float plane on Lake LaBarge up in the Yukon. You know, you've got those. And then, you know, you're camping there, fighting the bugs. There's nothing quite like springtime in the Yukon.
No, definitely.
Or the Arctic, for that matter. But also making sure that at night you go out and you're armed, but you've also got your bear spray. That being said, I mean, up there in the Arctic, when I've been there, as well as in the Yukon, you understand that you're taking that pepper spray. That's not to keep the bear away. That's just to season yourself before he eats you, right? So there's been those. I mean, usually isolated places well beyond where most planes or people go, where it's a charter. Those have been challenging. Others have been those which have been extremely difficult tech dives. They come and they go. Ultimately, I do recall there's some missions where you go, oh, this is tough, or that was difficult, or wow, that was dangerous. I mean, we were in the Saratoga Bikini about 130 feet down. And the entire quarter collapsed behind us after we'd laid our line.
No way. You actually had it collapse on you while you were laying your line.
Yeah. And so suddenly it's, once again, it's San Francisco Bay. And it's like, okay, Master Sergeant Bowen, we just stopped. We went mast to mast. It was Fabio Amaral. He was the head of the Bikini tourism dive stuff. And we were there. He was showing me what they'd done. And we were filming with Al Giddings for a special on Discovery in 1999. And it's like, okay. And what was that little, that's your ass. Because it just, so you're, okay. So you just take a deep breath. We went up because the entire overhead had collapsed. We couldn't, debris completely blocked our way back into the aircraft hangar. We couldn't get out that way. So we went up into the next corridor and went out to it. But I knew from the plans, because you do your homework, right?
Yeah.
Went to the end of the corridor, and instead of a hatch here, there was a little leg, and you went up to another hatch, but it was still dogged. And it had been dogged since July of 1946. So we just took those big dive knives out, and we beat on that rust and those dogs, and then got it to go. And then I leaned up against the bulkhead, and you know, those big military issue black rubber fins, you know.
Yeah.
I kicked on that thing until it got ajar. And we were able, because we were in doubles, we were able to squeeze through and into the bomb elevator, which I knew the hatch on the deck was open. But with that, it was one of those, because when we kicked the door open, we'd stop just before some nose fuses of some of these bombs. And so up and out. So yeah, there's stories like that usually, you know, divers like to tell to each other after.
Yeah, that one would be pretty intense. I with my vision, I'm blind in my one eye, and I've got glaucoma in the other, so I decided when I started to get back into diving again, since I am now disabled, that I'm going to take it easy and no penetration.
Yeah, no. And I promised my wife ultimately, not after that immediately, but not to go into wrecks anymore.
Did that take a lot of... What was her reaction when she heard this story?
It was better than the time when diving with the Russians on Titanic, the Mir 2 got stuck under the stern for a half hour or so.
No way.
Yeah.
So tell me more about this in the Mir.
Well, I was diving with the Russians in 2000. They just opened it up for dive tourism, and they said, hey, you know wrecks, and you've talked about Titanic, and why don't you come on out and see how these are. And these tourists were paying about $35,000 apiece to dive. So first off, it's a chance to see Titanic up front. And it's free. But it's also an opportunity to see how people interact with this wreck, which, you know, is important. And ultimately ended up being, well, here, the U.S. official on the policy side in charge of how the U.S. dealt with Titanic. So it was that would be 10 years after this, and after we'd moved, you know, back to the States. But there it was. So anyway, we're in the Mir 2, and Zhenya Chernyayev is taking us carefully, and I'm asking, let's see this, let's see that. And we come up to the stern. And people don't realize how strong the currents are around Titanic. That seabed can move, and these currents can just come around. So anyway, we were up and looking at the propellers, and all of a sudden, whoosh, and right under the hang of the stern on the port side. And it's like, okay. And Jenny's like, and the props are going, and there's sediment coming up, and you can hear this crunching. And he goes, okay. So he sets it down for a second. Everything with Zhenya, and like the Russians, they're sort of imperturbable. It's like, no problem. I said, okay. So he just carefully works it just a little bit. And after, 20 minutes, I don't know, it seemed like an eternity, but it was probably 20 to 30 minutes, I think. He got us out.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh, okay. He says, now where do you want to go? And I said, let's go around the other side of the stern and let's go into the engine room. Okay, no problem. And so off we go. And with that, you know, it's open at the top. You've got the railings on the side. The deck is peeled back. So you're going into the engine room. The only way you can do it is between those two, like, four-story high engines. So we're going in through it, and he's just very carefully driving us, no current. And we were some of the few. I asked him, I said, have you done this before? He said, when they were filming Titanica, we went in a bit with Ralph, and it got kind of rusty. I said, okay, have you done it since? He goes, no, but no problem. So in we go, and looking, and you just really had this sense, because levers are in certain places. I mean, it's damaged and crushed and torn open. But in some ways, it's still this place where these guys, these heroic engineers, stayed till the end to keep the lights on. And you think about that. Now, I looked over and it was like, oh, no way. Because hanging on a little wire hook on the railing was a metal teapot.
Really?
That these guys had. And it's, again, I think as an archaeologist, I'm always looking at things that speak to people. It's not just how the ship's built or how it died and broke apart. It's the human story. And so I looked at that and went, and I flashed back to a scene in the 1958 film, A Night to Remember. And whether they knew that teapot or not, or maybe that's just a feature of most British engine rooms, it's getting towards the end before the ship sinks, and the chief engineer's telling the guys, well, that's basically it. And he says the captain said he'll give, you know, the abandoned ship order, and then we can go. And one guy says, not much chance for us, chief. And he goes, anybody fancy a cup of tea? And I thought at the time, well, that's interesting cinematic, but who knows? Here's this teapot. Did something like that happen there? It doesn't matter exactly if it happened like that in the movie or not. The point is that for me, it was a reminder of how brave those engineers were. And most of them died in that space that I was then floating in. And they may be gone, but the sense of them is not. And so.
How many times have you been on the Titanic?
Two expeditions, 2000 and then in 2010, where we used robotic vehicles to completely map everything, the entire seabed, with the separate pieces, Titanic bow and stern, plus the field of scattered hull and machinery and everything that fell out of the ship. So those two missions. I was chief scientist for 2010.
Wow, that's fascinating. I mean, I've recently, as we were talking before, I know a friend of yours, Steve Santini, who actually has TitanicZone.com that supplies stuff to museums with Titanic stuff, and
right.
I've been hanging out at his place recently, so it's pretty awesome. I never ever thought I would have Titanic stuff in my hands.
Steve helped us out a great deal when I was director of the Vancouver Maritime Museum. I was director for 15 years. In 1997, we decided to do an exhibition on Titanic. And it, of course, this had nothing that had come up from the wreck, but we had pieces that had floated up that had been collected by Mackie Bennett, Minia, Montmagny, the other ships that had collected the bodies. We also were able to draw upon things that had been shared by Clive Cussler when he was working on his book, Ray's Titanic, Walter Lord. So it was basically a story of Titanic, the ship, Titanic, the wreck, Titanic as it had then become part of a pop culture, for letter words, or a cultural icon. Steve helped us out, and I think one of the most powerful artifacts we had in the exhibit was a blouse, third class probably, that had been in floating baggage. And this blouse, as I recall, had been altered for numerous wearers. And so you looked at that and you thought, and I remember all of us looking at it as he unpacked it and as we ultimately put it in its display case, was whom that had belonged to. Probably somebody coming across to start a new life. This was something that had been passed from hand to hand. It had been a fancy blouse probably in the 1870s. And here it is decades later, modified and passed from mother to mother, probably from the original family that had it to somebody perhaps who'd been somebody working for them, from them to that person. And so here it is. And whether that individual survived that night or not, this was something that spoke powerfully to that group of people for whom Titanic was a voyage to start a new life, and that's for so many ended up being a journey that ended tragically.
Yeah, he has a staggering amount of artifacts and personal items from the Titanic. It's a very impressive the amount of stuff that he's acquired over the years.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about what do you consider out of all the expeditions that you have done your favorite or that you've been most captivated by? Which I'm sure is hard to narrow down.
What was the song back decades ago? Was it To All the Girls I've Loved Before? Was that Willie Nelson that sang that?
Yeah.
I haven't met a wreck that hasn't had a powerful story to tell, even if it doesn't have a name. I think where I'm at now is that I look back on all of them with awe, at times with excitement over what we were able to see or learn, but also, I think, what we were able to share. So it's not a question so much of any one project. It's really the sum total of it all, which is why, again, I wrote the book. It's what do these things mean? What do they mean to different members of our society? What have they meant over time? And what can I say about what I saw that shares it with them without being another dive memoir? I mean, and I did when after, you know, we were working with Mike and Warren and John and Bill and everybody else. Is it Lisa, Susan? I mean, the whole team of sea hunters. I did write, you know, Adventures of a Sea Hunter with Douglas and McIntyre to share a bit of what we'd seen and what we'd learned. What it comes down to is not just the wrecks, it's the people. It's not just those people there, but it's the people that you meet. Whether it's the guys when we were in the lakes looking for Avro Aero test models. Whether it's in Finland when we're diving and exploring that and Mike is down and on the Vrouw Maria with Catherine the Great's paintings. Whether it's in Turkey from the Gallipoli campaign. Whether it's diving in Japan with them on Kublai Khan's lost fleet. Whether it's with my Park Service colleagues on the Summers in Mexico or the Arizona or Bikini or the wrecks up and down the California coast or the wrecks at Cape Cod or the wrecks at Fort Jefferson and so on. I mean, down to the most one of the more profound wrecks that I've ever worked on, the last known ship to bring people from Africa to enslave them in the States with Clotilda, which we just wrapped up a couple years ago. They all have meaning and power. And so that's what I look back on as I say, wow, what a career I've been lucky and privileged and that I've worked hard for. And to that end, I'm still not done. We just recently went out with robotic vehicles and dived the two Japanese carriers sunk at Midway, the big ones, Kaga and Akagi, and the USS Yorktown, you know, 15,000 feet down. And those kinds of dives, they still, I mean, particularly when with those, we're doing them broadcast live without a paywall. So people are able to join in and they're able to ask questions to the educators and then we can answer them as we're doing the work. That's been exciting. I mean, not done yet, but even if I'm not physically diving, but it all together is just like, wow. And again, coming back to it, that's why the Great Museum of the Sea as a title gets it part of it, but it's also the great cemetery, the great museum, the great cultural icon, the great environment that supports marine life. It's all these different reasons. I got into this because I was a kid who loved to learn, and I'm still learning.
Yeah. So tell me more about your book.
So the book, again, you know, just I know the publisher will be happy. Oxford University Press, written more for a public audience. And with it, what I've tried to do is to say shipwrecks are part of our story. Ships are the oldest artifacts we probably have made, aside from hand axes and bows and arrows and things of that sort. And I think tens of thousands of years ago, people were building some form of watercraft to populate the world. How do you get in more than 80,000 years ago? How do people get from Central Asia down to the coast or from Africa and then go to Australia? They didn't walk. How did the Polynesians spread out over thousands of years? They're building sophisticated craft that archaeologists would not really find a trace of if they came apart and sank thousands of feet down. So from that point of view, and going back to another book I'd done called Lost Warships, and it was a sense of, and I did that in Canada, Douglas and McIntyre, but then I followed up with a very new and different book called War at Sea, A Human History, based on shipwrecks. The idea is, how do we connect these to history? But how have we responded? How many movies have been made? How many books have been written? How many songs have been sung? How many of these are seen as grave sites? How many others have been the subject of amazing technology, not just to find them, but to recover them, whether for salvage or treasure hunting or for archaeology? I talked to so many of my colleagues. I've seen so much of that. When we were doing Sea Hunters, we went out off of Roberts Bank, and Mike with our colleagues there, particularly with Richie Kohler, dived the U-215, a mine-laying sub on its way to Boston, and sunk because, as one of the family members that we later talked to said, the captain, he had a sore throat. And I said, what do you mean? He said, he ached for the Iron Cross. So instead of going on to his mission to lay the mines, ship is coming by loaded with war material, and he sank it. But then a British anti-submarine group jumped on him and sank him. And so we dived U-215, but we also went and looked at the other wreck, which was deep, not too deep. And that was where Risdon Beasley had gone and done amazing post-war salvage. And so the book talks about that kind of thing. It talks about how Costa Concordia got raised. It talks about what treasure hunters do. The idea was just to say, these are all the ways shipwrecks mean something to us in different ways. These are the ways where we have dealt with them in terms of learning how to dive, how to recover, how we share their stories, and why people care is ultimately.
That's amazing. I can't wait to read. I actually just ordered the audio version of it, so which
Good.
I'm looking forward
Good.
To.
I haven't heard it yet. They don't let the author read it, but that is.
Why didn't they let you read it?
I don't know, because probably they'd say I'd probably be going. The island community was ultimately doomed by tensions and the behavior of the sailors, which led to a massacre that left only two of the Britons alive. And I'm talking, of course, about the Bounty. At this point, I'd say, hey, I'm talking about the Bounty here. And, you know, the most cool thing was when we landed at Pitcairn and we met these descendants. And that's why they probably didn't let me read it.
I had Jill Heinarth on, and she said that it was really hard to actually read her book and stick to it just because of what you
Exactly. You don't write these things to make money. You write them to share, and you write them because they're a labor of love.
Which is awesome.
And now, for my wife at least, she said, now maybe you can stop telling these stories at the dinner table. She's heard them all, and she still wants to listen. She's really good that way.
Well, that's good that you have a partner that supports you so well, or has supported you for so many years doing
yeah.
what you do, especially since you're all over the place. Your travel schedule is insane, even now.
And I'm retired.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, that's the fun part of it, is that you get to meet colleagues and people that you like, that you've worked with. You get to meet the people coming up in the field. I just went to Ostend, Belgium to attend this World Congress on Maritime Archaeology. And it was great to see old friends, but it was also great to meet students and people just coming into the field and them asking questions, or just in a couple cases for advice. That was fun. But the other part of it was, they asked me to do a public presentation, and, you know, the hall got filled. I guess they had about 400 folks. And then afterwards, we had a reception, and the people that wanted to just come up and ask a question. And that's part of the reason why I do what I do, is I don't just do this to write an academic treatise or put something in a shelf. It's to learn. And by learning, I mean, that involves conversations with people. What do you think about this? What do you think about that? What is this? And I'll come back to that point in a second. But also, why people care. And that's, through all the years, that's one of the reasons I didn't want to speak for any of them, but drawing from what people had said, I put that into this book. So it was fun to meet these folks and to have a chance to talk with them and to be an accessible scientist above and beyond having done this when we've been out online on the internet doing the deep dives. And with that, coming back to that point, we're all in there, and all these brilliant archaeologists and others, and we're inside a wreck off the north coast of California, a ship called Ituna. One guy died in the wreck. So we're inside the hold, which is opened up, and there's all this gear here, and somebody says, what kind of machinery is that? And I'm looking and I'm saying, that's not marine machinery. What is that? Now, the public can write in, and this one writes in, and the educators say, Jim, it's a mechanical fish processing machine that would gut and behead and chop it into chunks that would then go into canned fish and canned salmon. And I went, I've seen one of those machines. It's actually, they've got one on display at the Gulf of Georgia cannery in Steveston, where we lived for so many years in BC. And I went, so that's what it is. And you wouldn't have known if this person who didn't know that hadn't called in. So, and they said, hey, thank you so much. And this is out to probably to millions of people. Thank you so much for this. And I said at the time, this is why we do what we do. It's not just so you can watch, but you can participate, and you've helped us answer a question. Thank you. And that wouldn't have happened unless he had tapped on my shoulder and written on the slate, it's a fish processing machine, stupid.
So you mentioned you did a lot of technical diving. What did you do, also any rebreather stuff or?
No. That all came into play. I listened very carefully to She Who Wears the Match to this.
So you apparently, your wife and my wife have something in common then, because that's the same rule she has with me, no rebreathers.
Right. No, Anne's always been very good about what I do, and she's worried. And I mean, she did sign the permission slip to dive with the Russians in the Mirs. The second time we went back to Titanic, she said, you're not diving. I said, no, the robot is. We're good here. No, and I get that. And the kids, I know, have their worries too, so no.
No, I get that. I mean, rebreathers definitely added extra risk involved in it. I'm actually gonna try one in a couple of weeks.
Ah, so she's gonna let you break the rule or bend it, huh?
She is only gonna let me bend the rule because I'm doing it in a pool and I'm doing it for my podcast.
Smart.
So
no, and I mean, I know the difference. I mean, when we were diving at Bikini, we were doing 180 feet on air.
Yeah.
So I remember about half those dives.
You got an arc that bad.
Well, not always. I mean, through the years, I think, well, you think you're not narked. Of course you are, in a way. Dan Lenihan and I were underneath the stern of the battleship Nagato, and it's at 180 feet. And I've got the video camera, and I'm filming it carefully, and I'm going, wow, okay, there's this here, that hatch is open, look at this, look at that, this stuff's fallen out. And we come back up, and after a very long deco, we're back on, and I open the camera, and every time I thought I'd turned it on, I turned it off. So the bulk of the footage actually is that thing clipped to my belt filming my crotch during the entire deco.
I don't know if it's just me or not, but I also find as you get older, you seem to get narked worse.
Yeah. So no, we did enough of that. I mean, summers, I mean, we're basically, that was about 110, 120. But no, Bikini, they were all, we always looked out for safari syndrome. We also staged it. One day after we'd gone lower, we'd be up, say, at the flight deck of Saratoga, which is half the depth, that kind of thing. Or we'd be up on the superstructure, and that going inside the bridge or Admiral's Bridge or, you know, that kind of thing.
Very cool. Yeah, I've had Peter Mesley on, who's dove at Bikini a bunch of times, so.
Yeah, no, he's great. What they do is wonderful.
Oh, yeah. I'm hoping to actually do a Truck Lagoon trip with him at some point.
Oh, yeah. No, those guys, they those wrecks as well. So very well-dived. And yet they keep adding more to the understanding that we have of them.
Yeah. which is amazing. I mean, you've obviously dove in bikini, correct? I imagine.
I've dove in bikini, but I've never dove at truck or chook.
Sorry. Oh, you no. haven't dove truck. Really?
No. No. The opportunity never really came up. Bikini was there because it wasn't open. And the first time we went with the Navy. We went with mobile diving salvage unit guys and explosive ordnance demolition guys because all the ships carried munitions. These guys had to gag a few bombs, fuses, you know, after we encountered them. Ultimately, when I came back, I said, hey, guys, we did a little more work in the archives, and look what's stenciled on the side of the bomb, and they all laughed because it said inert. But not all of them were.
Yeah.
So, but no, bikini just was, nobody'd been. We were the first to dive it, other than a handful of people and the Navy scientific resurveys.
Which is really cool.
Yeah.
So tell me, since you worked with Mike and Warren for so long on the Sea Hunters, you got to have a funny story to tell me about Mike and Warren. There has to have been something major funny. Okay, I can tell from the grin you got something.
I think that the funniest story is basically when we're all together as a team, and this is about two-thirds of the way through the years of the run. And we were all beginning to understand that we weren't just being watched in Canada, but it had gone globally to like 140 other countries. Yeah. So we're in Panama and we're in a boat coming back from diving this early 1860s submarine that sticks out at low tide. And we're approaching this tiny little village at the edge of the Islas Perlas in the Bahia de Panama. And all the kids suddenly start chanting on the beach, Canal Cinco, Canal Cinco, Canal Cinco. And the boys are like, huh? And I said, Channel 5. And they look at each other and they look at me and they look at the other and they go. And with that, it's like, wow, I guess people are watching. But the fact that here all these kids were watching, that was pretty cool. And so it's not a funny story in a haha kind of way. It was a funny story in a profound way, but also just to see the look on those two guys' faces. Because I'm sure as I was looking at theirs, they were looking at mine as well going... There were so many great times that we had together. I mean, obviously, we're traveling together. There are times I'm sure some of us would just sort of go like, okay, you've said that before, or where's my dive gear? But no, I think the most important thing that all of us had when came away from this was that we were really a family. And working with those guys and the others, absolutely. And I'd be remiss if I didn't just say that not too terribly long ago, we lost John Davis, who had created that series and that we'd worked with. And John, of course, was a character in those first seasons. He passed. They had a memorial service for him that I could not make because I was far, far away. He lived, of course, still out there in Nova Scotia. But no, I look back on those times in the sea hunting days with a great deal of happiness, pride that we're able to do something and to represent and to be a bunch of Canadians out there practicing what we preached in terms of Cussler used to say, now it's your turn to get out there, to get up off that couch, go out in the mountains, the deserts, the oceans, and search for history. There's nothing better. We got to do that. Thanks to Clive and John. And the incredible spirit of teamwork, the brothers like those guys, all that team that I worked with, and the women too, the brothers and the sisters, so that made Sea Hunters happen.
What's your most memorable thing about Clive that you can tell me? There we go again.
Cussler and the wives, and I, we're all on a ship sailing in the South Pacific, and we go to Pitcairn. And we land, and he's thinking he's going to be incognito. But he's Clive Cussler. And so he and I, we're walking up the trail, and this big guy comes up. His name was Pirate Pete. And Pete says, "Is that Clive Cussler?" And I went, "Yeah." So he says, "Hold on." And I said, "Hey, Clive, hang on a second." And this guy runs back, and he comes back with this really much beaten paperback. I can't remember which title it was. And he goes, "Would you sign this?" And ordinarily, you know, I'm sure Clive's been presented to people that are like, "Here's a pristine book, never read." He looks at it and he goes, "I'd love to." Because it had been well loved and read by many people on this island. And so he ordered, and that was one of the most fun moments of all, where just the look on Cussler's face was like...
Well, I guess, especially since you're in Pitcairn, which is like about as remote as you can get.
Yeah.
So what's it like to visit Pitcairn?
It was amazing. And first, it's not easy to get there. I'm not just talking about the long sail. It's just landing, because that opens swell. When we left, our Zodiac was like this. But it's a stage upon which an incredible human drama played out, not just with the mutineers landing and establishing the community, but what happened afterwards, and so on. I mean, Pitcairn has a very difficult human history. So you're seeing all of that, but you're meeting the people, and you can see you're actually there where Fletcher Christian was, where Adams, where all these guys were, plus the Polynesians. And you see that not only in the place itself, but in the people. It's one of the more profound places I've visited of many.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, cool. Well, thank you very much for coming on today. I really appreciate you having on the podcast. It has been amazing to finally meet you and talk to you.
Likewise.
And maybe I can get you on again sometime at some point, since you're retired.
Yeah.
And thank you, everybody, for watching the Deadfoot Diver podcast. And remember, like and subscribe, and I'll see you next time.